virtually every single person favored hitting tremendously, and only Clay Link was even close to a 50-50 split in the league. So, I mean, for those who don't know, I spent $200 on my pitching staff, $201 to be exact, and kind of blew a lot of valuations out of the water.
Here's to us, November, and the waning sun, and all the proofs I'd like to prove. We go down tonight.
Hello and welcome to episode 164 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. I'm your host, George Bissell. And I'm joined by Mike Gianella of the BP Fantasy Team. We're recording this podcast on Tuesday, March 20th. We're in the middle of Nor'easter number 4. And Mike, I understand it started snowing down in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, kind of. Like it was more sleeting, and now it's like nothing. But I think it's supposed to really start like overnight. They already closed my kid's school, so yeah.
If you can kind of tell by my tone, I'm kind of done with winter. It's getting to be a little ridiculous. And, you know, the season, it's now 9 days away as we record this pod, and I'm done with winter. I'm ready for baseball. And you're coming off Tout Wars weekend. I mean, how was all of that? I didn't get a chance to go down to New York, but it looked like it was a really cool experience. You guys were down in Staten Island, and
well, you know, a lot of people coming in were, you know, not publicly, but griping a little bit about the venue and going to Staten Island. But I have to say, it was great. Like, so it was where the Staten Island Yankees play, you know, which is obviously one of the Yankees affiliates. And, you know, it was just a cool venue. It was a great view of New York's, like, Manhattan when you were there. And there was, like, a batting cage, like, right by the locker room where people were actually allowed to, like, practice and take swings. So, you know, the people hosting just did an awesome job of making us feel welcome. And if they do it there again next year, I have no complaints.
I got to ask, who had the best cuts of any that you saw? I got to know.
I didn't see all of them, but, you know, I'm going to make everybody else mad by saying this. But Derek Van Riper, he had that uppercut and that launch angle down.
He went to Launch Angle University. There we go. Yeah. Nice work, DVR. All right, so as I was just saying, the season's 9 days away. And did you know this, Mike? It's going to be the first time that all 30 teams will start the season on the same day since 1968.
I was not aware of that.
It's pretty crazy. And, you know, spring training, it's in full swing. It's time to start thinking about Yahoo Fantasy Baseball drafts. Crush your league with the Yahoo Fantasy app. Yahoo Fantasy has been rated number one by the FSTA 5 years in a row. Draft, trade, and manage your team right from your phone. Get the expert advice and analysis you need to make moves like a big league GM. Sign up by downloading the app or by going to yahoo.com/flagsflyforever. That's yahoo.com/flagsflyforever. Yahoo Fantasy Baseball, the official fantasy game of Major League Baseball. We've got a really cool show tonight planned. We have a very special guest coming on. It's someone it's been too long. We've been meaning to have him on for a long time. And before we introduce him, just a brief bit of housekeeping, and then we'll introduce our very awesome guest to talk about Tout Wars. Subscribe to Baseball Prospectus with a 1-year premium membership. That's how you can read Mike and I at BP. If you do the super premium membership, you get access to the Bat Signal. It's our personalized fantasy answering service. It's awesome. Subscribe, rate, review us on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts from. You know, you might wonder, like, why do I need to do that? Well, we have a bunch of new listeners at this time of the year, and we do this podcast every week. We do it for free. It's the one thing you can do that really helps us out tremendously. So subscribe, rate, review us. Follow us on Twitter. Mike is at Mike Gianella, and I am at George Bissell. All right, our guest tonight is a writer for FanGraphs and Fantasy Alarm. He's the co-host and producer of the Sleeper and the Bust podcast. He's also the owner of Friends with Fantasy Benefits and the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational. He is the hardest working man in fantasy, Justin Mason. Justin, thanks for coming on.
I don't know if I'm necessarily the hardest working man in fantasy, but I definitely have fooled a lot of people into believing that.
You certainly seem busy to me, I'll tell you that. And you were down at Tout Wars as well. So that was your second draft, right? You drafted last year, but this is your
I was a proxy for Stefania Bell last year.
Yeah. So what was this experience like for you going back for the second time? Like Mike said, different venue. So this must have been pretty awesome to get in the room for the first time as your own entry into Tout.
I was definitely very grateful that I had the opportunity to draft last year because it gave me an idea of the pace, which I don't think people really give enough credit for in terms of these industry or expert leagues, how quick these auctions really move and how much crap you get if you mess up. It was nice to have had that kind of foundation last year. But I mean, you know, this is my own team. Like it wasn't like last year I was able to like draft for Stefania Bell. Everybody loved my team. I was able to hand it off to her and go, well, if it gets messed up, I can't, I'm not taking any of the credit, but I'll take all the credit if you win. This year it's like all on me.
Absolutely. Mike, how many years have you been in Tout? This is quite a few. You're a veteran. You're a champion of NL Tout previously. How many years now?
Yeah, I've won once. This is my ninth year. So, you know, if I get to 12 years and you win once, that's like actually kind of average because, you know, there's 12 people in the NL. That's a depressing way to look at it. But yeah, Justin, just to add to that, yeah, I'll never forget the first auction. And, you know, at that point I wasn't with BP. I had this like kind of tiny blog that nobody had heard of. I joked it was like a trade blog and that people in the industry read it. And like, I almost had no other readers because it was like all only stuff. And I got, you know, invited to the auction as a last-second replacement, similar to Justin, except I got to run the team. And it was a whirlwind. Like, you're sitting there, and you're like, holy crap. Like, this is a redraft they're going to do in 3.5 hours. Like, this is insane. Like the home league, you know, my home league is like a five-hour where there's, like, you know, 10 keeps on average per team, and it's slow, and there's, like, three breaks. Mm-hmm. It is intense. And, you know, it might sound like an excuse to someone listening who's never seen it or done one of these and thinking, oh, yeah, I could do this better than you. It's like, it's actually a big part of the challenge. And I'd say the first one for me was a similar thing. I made some mistakes I wouldn't have made, you know, if I had been used to the pace.
Yeah, especially for me because I'm, you know, my first one, you know, I come in, I've never met anybody outside of, you know, like the night before at Foley's when like three people were there and none of them were in this draft. And so I sit down and I've got Todd Zola like hovering above me as the auctioneer. I sit across from one of my bosses in Paul Spohr and next to my other boss in Howard Bender. And I'm like, oh, well, this is great. If I mess up, you know, I'm probably getting fired here.
You know what this reminds me of? Remember in Talladega Nights when they're like, does anyone want to go fast? And then Ricky Bobby gets in the car and then, you know, he's out on the track. And that's what it must have felt like for you guys, your first auction. So, yeah, the pace and the speed of it, you know, it's so much faster. You really have to know your stuff inside and out and adjust a lot faster, I would imagine, than any other draft out there. So we're going to talk a lot about Tout Wars tonight. I do want to start off with a couple of current events because we don't usually do this, but I feel like there were a couple of stories that I feel like we do need to touch on. So, Mike, I want to start off with Justin Turner. He suffered what's been described as a small non-displaced fracture of his left wrist. The good news is that it looks like he's going to avoid surgery. And the Dodgers haven't exactly given us a timetable as far as what, you know, his return is going to be. But based on some other guys who suffered this type of injury, we're expecting at least, you know, 4 to 5 weeks. So I wouldn't plan on seeing Justin Turner until at least probably May. What does this do to Turner's value in redraft leagues? Because a lot of people maybe still haven't drafted. This is the last big weekend as far as drafts go for home leagues or NFBC. So how are you approaching the situation with Justin Turner?
Yeah, you know, in a redraft, I won't say I won't touch him because you know me. Like if he falls in at the right price, that's fine. And I'm certainly not the first person to say this isn't new or original, but it's the power I'm kind of worried about with him. You know, he's not a big power hitter, but if he loses some power and you're talking about more of an average hitter, you know, or somebody who, you know, still hits 300, but it, you know, is like a 15 home run pace, maybe 20 home run pace guy. That's still good. And that's something you want on your team and you almost anything, but like a 10 team mix, but it's not the guy we were looking at heading into the season. I imagine he might not run. He barely runs, but I imagine he might not run either. Just, you know, be careful about that. So, you know, yeah, the value takes a hit. I'm bumping him down about a third in my next update in terms of the valuations and the bid limits. I don't think he's going to miss that much time, but I think you have to bake in like a slight decline in the performance when he comes back.
Yeah, so I'm looking at your latest edition of the bid limits, which came out, I want to say, last week or...
It was last Friday.
Yeah.
And then the next one will come out when you guys listen to this on the following Friday, which will be the 23rd.
Yeah. So you had Justin Turner as a $21 hitter in your mixed league bid limits. I mean, how you said you drop him quite a bit. I mean, let me give you some names here, and I want to see if you'd slot them behind them. Kyle Seager at $16.
I think I'd put him behind Seager now.
Joey Gallo, also 16.
Yeah, behind Gallo, too.
All right, Adrian Beltre at 15.
Yeah, I think I'd still put him behind Beltre.
All right, let me go a little further down. Mike Moustakas, $8.
I think I'd put him, well, you know, I think I'd put him ahead of Moose, just again because of the average, but there you're probably talking about a preference in terms of your needs and what you're looking at. That's also a lineup factor too. You know, I've said before, runs on RBI can be a little bit overstated, but the difference between the Dodgers and the Royals should be significant this year, even with the improvements the Royals have made.
All right,
so I'd go with Turner there.
Yeah, that's after Beltre, Sano, Eduardo Nunez, who you're probably using at second base, and Rafael Devers at $10. So Justin, does that sound about right to you? And how are you approaching the Justin Turner? Because it obviously sucks, but I think like. The overreaction may go too far. There might actually be a buying opportunity here in a strange way, I think. So what are your thoughts on the Justin Turner injury? And does that sound like the right range as far as where you would drop him?
I think if you were a Justin Turner fan coming into the season, that this shouldn't drop him extremely far until we get an official timetable. And I don't know if the one you gave out is an official one. I hadn't seen one as of yet.
No, Yep.
Yeah, I mean, this is supposedly, it's non-displaced, so they're not having to, like, reset the bone or do surgery. It's supposedly a small fracture. You do worry about the power being affected long-term. My main issue with Justin Turner, and I have him lower prior to this in my ranks than a lot of people, is I don't trust the playing time to begin with, just because he has had issues staying on the field in the past. So now he's starting the year with a broken wrist. You know, you got to think he's going to miss more time at some point already. We're talking about a 33-year-old guy with a long history of health issues. He's probably dropping farther for me than he is for Mike, but he was probably lower for me to start with than it was for Mike.
Yeah, those are all valid points. I think the concern about the power once he does return with it being a wrist injury, that's a very fair criticism. I don't really have any way to counter that.
Well, I just my thing is, like, it's funny. I had a little bit of playing time concerns baked into his projection, Justin. Like, I'm definitely not the high man on the totem pole on Turner.
Mm-hmm.
I've just noticed, you know, and I don't have him anywhere. Like, I've just noticed someone drafts or buys him higher. But yeah, I do agree with that about the playing time. And to me, it's not even so much the nature of the injury or the timetable. Like, for one thing, this is just the back of the napkin calculation.
Yeah.
Like, if I look at it and analyze it come Friday, this might not be the official position. Like, don't come back to me and say, hey, Mike, you said on the podcast you were doing this and you did that. But just the other piece is I tend to be cautious with injuries, especially when they're first developing like this. And, like, if I had to, like, you know, if I had an auction tonight, or tomorrow night, I'd be erring on the side of caution, just because I'd rather not roster a guy like Turner than go overpriced or go too priced and be like, yeah, like, I wish I didn't have him.
I guess the way I look at it is it's sort of similar now to Adrian Beltre, in my opinion. Beltre is going to be 39 years old. He had under 400 plate appearances last year. And you have him, Mike, at $15 in your bid limits. And look, you might say on a per plate appearance basis, Beltre's maybe better, but I don't think the gap between once you get after Beltre and Sano and Devers, like the gap between him and like Evan Longoria and Michael Franco and those lower tier options. I think at that point, I'd rather take a shot that Turner comes back and he looks like the guy we expect him to be. That's just kind of my point on Turner.
Well, you know, the other thing too, just to give Justin context or our listeners context, we're talking about a 15 team mix for the bid you're talking about. You know, in a 10 or 12 team mix, there's definitely a difference. Like, you taking Turner there and be like, you know what, it's a standard or it's a 12 teamer. If he doesn't pan out, I can just grab somebody else. Yeah, that's a little bit different. You know, I guess the question in a 12 teamer is, do you want to use one of your two DL slots if it's like an ESPN on Turner? You know, I don't know. I mean, I would say probably, but, you know, it might also depend on your team and, you know, how you put it together.
All right, so some recent signings. There were a couple that I wanted to highlight here to get your guys' thoughts on them. Alex Cobb, as we're recording this tonight, he looks like he's reached a four-year deal with the Baltimore Orioles. Jake Arrieta signed a three-year deal with Philadelphia. Lance Lynn, a one-year deal with Minnesota. Justin, which one of those guys is the most interesting to you as far as the landing spot goes, relative to what your impressions were a few weeks ago when we didn't know where they were going to sign?
I mean, I prefer Lance Lynn in Minnesota over Alex Cobb in Baltimore. that's for sure. I mean, from a straight baseball perspective, like, if Lance Lynn had waited 2 weeks to sign, would he have gotten this kind of Alex Cobb deal from someone? I haven't been a big fan of Cobb. I think there's been some sharp skill declines since coming back from Tommy John, and I don't think the Baltimore Park in Camden Yards is going to do him any favors. I saw some kind of rough projections out there from like Derek Carty that had him at like a 4.6 ERA and like 6.5 Ks per nine.
Yeah, that's not great.
That's not good. But like that, like increases the team's like WAR by like 2 runs because that's what they were dealing with in Baltimore. You know, and all this is like I said, according to Derek Carty's projections. I haven't like, you know, really sat down and kind of mapped it out for myself. But Alex Cobb's one of those guys that wasn't going to be in my draft plans no matter where he signed, more than likely. And this like just kind of puts the nail in the coffin. I like Lance Lynn, though. I think he is perpetually underrated.
Yeah, I mean, a guy who constantly outperforms his peripherals, right? That's kind of been the Lance Lynn story. And Mike, Jake Arrieta, I don't think we had a chance to talk about this on the last podcast, but he's a guy where I think the landing spot is interesting. Philadelphia kind of underrated as a pitcher's park, I think. I think it's going to be good for Arrieta. And if he can reverse some of the trends that we saw as far as the velocity and some of the control issues that kind of plagued him the last two seasons or so, I think Arrieta is actually really interesting. And I know you took the plunge on him in labor. This is Jake Arrieta, I think this is interesting for him. I'm intrigued.
Well, you know, there's a couple things about Arrieta. One is that actually Philadelphia, I believe, is in terms of run suppression for base hits, it is. But the last year or two, it's been a bad home run park. So the key for Arrieta is going to be getting that ground ball rate back up to 50%, which is where it was in 2015 and 2016. Ben Harris over at The Athletic, I know it's a subscription site, but he wrote a really great piece about Arrieta and the adjustment he made in the second half and how he moved away from the slider. And, you know, there's some analysts who've kind of been like dogging Arrieta and saying, oh, you know, he's not throwing the slider. You know, he's not effective. He's lost the pitch. It actually is, if you read Harris's article, it was a very deliberate thing. It wasn't Arrieta panicking. It was an approach issue. So, yes, the velocity's down. Yes, there are, you know, you always would prefer to have a pitcher with more velocity, but there's a method to Arrieta's madness. If he gets that ground ball rate back up, you know, J.P. Crawford, you know, he might not be the greatest player to have on in your fantasy team, but if he sticks with the team, that defense is going to be a plus. You're going to have Hernandez, which is going to be a plus. I think Arrieta is kind of a sneaky option this year. He's not going to be what he was in 2015. You know, that's off the table. But I'd say he has a sneaky option to be like a number two starter in mixed leagues. And, you know, a lot of people are down on him. So there's a bit of a buying opportunity there, if you believe.
Yeah. Justin, are you buying Jake Arrieta?
You know, let me real quick, like, see what his ADP has been over the last 2 weeks. Because, I mean, that for me is you know, the biggest question mark, because I, you know, Paul Sporer over on Sleeper on the Bust with me, you know, thought his ADP would rise. I thought it would lower. It's currently at about 106, the 38th pitcher off the board, according to NFBC.
Is that the last 2 weeks?
That's over the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's dropped, too, because I know, yeah. I think it was in the 80s. Where it was in the 80s, I would agree mm-hmm. that was kind of high, and like where it is now, I kind of like it.
Yeah, and I do, too. It's one of those things where I think people heard so many people talk about how bad of a ballpark Philadelphia would be because I think it's given up like the third most home runs over the course of the last couple of years. But Arrieta is a smart pitcher and he's a guy in really great shape. My issue with him is always going to be is his mechanics in line. When he's bad mechanically, that's when he's bad on the field. And he really struggled keeping his mechanics consistent and clean last year. So maybe new pitching coach can help him kind of resurrect the stuff that Bosio did for him when he came over from Baltimore. And you could see a bounce back. You know, this is a guy that was a top 10 starting pitcher in fantasy. You know, I don't think he can necessarily get back there, but can he not get back to top 20 guy? I think it's possible he can.
Right. At the current price, I mean, there's a lot of room for
profit. It's
worth
the gamble.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Some other really quick notes. Jorge Polanco was suspended 80 games for testing positive for performance-enhancing drugs. This sucks for me. I had lots of shares of Jorge Polanco. I think I really liked what he did over the last 2 months of the season. I think if you thought that was real, there was a lot to like about Jorge Polanco. Now I don't know if he's even mixed league relevant at this point, maybe in deeper formats if you want to take a shot as a middle infielder, but it's tough because you can't even DL him. You have to burn the roster spot. It's not great. So Jorge Polanco, not good. And the other note here, Ronald Acuna was sent down yesterday, I believe. So
shocking.
Yeah, he's just not ready, guys. I mean, he just he really struggled this spring. He was just he looked lost at the plate. It was brutal. I totally understand it.
It's just a matter of like how long will it take him to get ready? I mean, you know, will he be ready by, you know, April 14th when the Braves get next year's service time? Or, you know, will it be like early July when he passes the Super 2 deadline? It's just, you know, who knows when he'll be ready.
It might be like 14 days, right? That's when that's the exact date. I think people have circled the exact date on the calendar. Mm-hmm. It's like Wrigley Field, I think. Ronald
Acuna. There's two opening days for a lot of fantasy owners this year. It's the actual opening day and the day that Ronald Acuna can come back up.
That's right. They need to change the rule. This needs to change. And I understand it's a collectively bargained. It's a CBA issue, but they need to fix this.
I'm sure it'll be on the table in 3 years when they renegotiate.
Ugh, it's brutal. All right. Last thing here. Any spring training storylines that you guys are following? I know we never want to read too much into spring training, but I know there are things that I watch and that I pick up on, and I was just curious if you guys had noticed anything before we dive into Tout Wars here. Justin, was there anything that you've been paying attention to or that's caught your eye that you've noticed over the last couple of weeks, or even if it's just something as simple as it's something that you've changed your opinion on? Is there anything like that that you've noticed here in the last couple of weeks?
I think there's like two guys in particular that I have been keeping a very close eye on. One was Zach Greinke with the kind of reduced velocity.
Oh, that's good.
That was terrifying for me because I had him as I think my sixth or seventh pitcher coming into spring training. I've dropped him a little bit, but I'm not as worried as maybe other people are in the industry. I think he'll be fine. And, you know, he did have that start where he had to leave with a groin injury, but was throwing in the 90s, which, you know, wasn't a guarantee from the previous outings. He's also one of those guys that if you were going to tell me there was a pitcher who was going to be successful, really reduced velocity, Zach Greinke is like one of the few guys that I would believe that was possible. He's just an extremely smart guy. He really understands the game, really understands analytics, does everything he can to kind of get a competitive advantage. So, you know, and the other guy is Madison Bumgarner. I was really discouraged by what I saw with him. Coming back from the injury, I felt like he had a really hard time hitting the catcher's glove within the zone. And so a lot of people are like, well, he got in the zone plenty, you know. And but it, for me, is, you know, the difference between command and control, you know, is he was having a hard time really picking his spots within the zone. He looks better, but he still isn't, to me, the guy he was prior to the injury.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up Zach Greinke, because we haven't talked about his spring issues on this podcast. And Mike, I feel like we went through this exercise a little bit last year with Max Scherzer, where I think you've made this point, or Brett has as well, that people kind of freaked out with the injury and they weren't sure if everything was all right. And then, sure enough, we get into the regular season, Scherzer's fine. Is this sort of similar to you in terms of how you're approaching Greinke, where you don't want to overreact too much? Or is there a little bit of a cause for concern when you're seeing these types of issues for Greinke?
I, you know, honestly, I'm probably more concerned about the groin than I am about the velocity. You know, he left with a groin injury in his last start, and the velocity, albeit in like one or two innings, was actually up. I think he'll be fine. Like, I probably ticked him down. Like, I think I ticked him down like a buck in my last update. You know, it's funny, like that was, I would have gotten him in tout if I had left my original price. So I did lose a little confidence in him, sure. But he's still somebody I'd be fine with, either as that like lesser ace if you're not going like one of the big four, or, you know, somebody who's your number two if you're going pitching heavy. So I'm okay with Greinke. I don't have a lot of fears about him. I think this is similar to Scherzer, where we're going to look back on this and be like, man, like, you know, we really missed the boat. Doesn't mean I think Greinke's going to do what he did last year, but I think he's still going to be pretty good.
Yeah. Was there anything that stood out to you this spring that you wanted to talk about?
Man, I hate to say this, but I'm getting sucked into Lucas Giolito.
Oh no!
One of the people who was at Tout Wars was Nick Pollock, who runs the Pitcher List, which is a great website. And you know, he was talking a little bit about, you know, how, you know, Giolito's problem has been that curveball; he can't command it. And there's a lot of reports, you know, talking about how Don Cooper's worked with him. And, you know, Giolito, if everything is working, I mean, he's a pitcher with 4+ pitches who can command all those pitches. It won't matter if he's not throwing as hard as he did in the low minors. He could still be very good. I don't oversell him. I'm not saying that Giolito is going to be like an ace, but I could see him kind of being a mid-tier guy. And, you know, Justin, you said you have the ADP open and I don't. Like, I think he's still going for like virtually nothing. Like he's just somebody you can kind of take at the back end of a draft and just stick him on your team and be like, if he works out, great. You know, if he doesn't work out, well, whatever. You know, I can just like throw him away.
236 overall, according to NFBC.
I mean, it's a little higher than I thought. You know, it's not exactly a nothing pick, but it's still a back end like pick.
The other part of NFBC, though, is there's no trading. So if you believe in the guy,
and pitching gets moved up.
Exactly. Right. So those guys tend to, I think it gets a little bit inflated there once you get past the elite pitchers. I think all those guys get pushed up a little bit. So just something to keep in mind. So if you like Giolito, I think don't be afraid to be a little aggressive with him.
Like,
if you're drafted
like I said,
this weekend.
I don't want to oversell it, but I'm just intrigued by what he's done. And Don Cooper has a pretty good record with young pitchers. So I'm moving him up a little bit in the next update.
All right. My spring training storyline, it's the Deep League special. This one goes out to all the hashtag beefy boys out there. But Dan Vogelbach.
this again.
Speaking of getting sucked in, my goodness, is he having a spring, folks. I got to tell you. 45 at-bats, he's batting over, I think he's batting 400 right on the nose, slugging .867, 5 home runs, 11 extra base hits, more walks than strikeouts. Look, they have on Baseball Reference the opponent quality, and he's faced like the equivalent of like double-A pitching, but he's still destroyed that level of pitching. That's look, there is a chance that he makes the opening day roster. And I'm just saying, if you're in an extremely deep league, Dan Vogelbach has always been able to hit. So we'll see what happens. That's all I'm saying. All right. Do you guys want to laugh at me about Dan Vogelbach, or can we move
Listen,
on?
I would be all over Dan Vogelbach if the Mariners didn't hate him.
I've had this. I think I talked about this with James Anderson, where I was like, why did they do this trade if they didn't know what they were getting? I don't understand it. So... Yeah.
I mean, DePoto is one of those guys that in every league has one of these guys, fantasy league. He's the, you know, that just can't stop trading. Like, there is like a serious addiction to it, and fair. Like he doesn't care about his team context or anything like that, or what he needs. He just wants to make the next trade. And
look, it's just frustrating. Like, at some point, you have to figure out if Dan Vogelbach can do this or not. He can't stay in AAA forever. At some point, you just need to give him 500 at bats and be like, look, either it happens or it doesn't. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
You know, so a point I'll make in Vogelbach's favor has less to do with him and more to do with Ryan Healy. You know, first of all, this is a sample size, like, splits alert. But, you know, Healy, after, like, hitting a ton of home runs in the first half, like, really faded in the second in terms of the power. And before that, he wasn't really much. Like, if that's what Healy is, like, if he's a low-power 270 hitter, I could see the Mariners be like, you know what, we're just going to give him a chance or at least try a platoon. So there's a bit of a window for Vogelbach. I think the Mariners might give him some more reps. So, I mean, put it this way, even if you believe in Ryan Healy is an Anthony Rizzo. It's not a situation where Vogelbach is blocked or can't perform or can't find his way into some playing time.
Yeah, I think if you're in an OBP league, he's really interesting. If you're in a deep OBP, I'm just saying, don't forget about him. All right, that's enough for Dan Vogelbach talk for like 2 months. I promise we're never gonna do that again. All right, let's talk about Tout Wars, guys. We're gonna start with Justin, your team. You were in the Tout Wars head-to-head auction. Can you, first of all, take us through your sort of overall process as you headed into the draft? What was your sort of game plan, your mindset? What were you setting out to do as you stepped into the room?
George, before we do that, like, Justin, would you mind also explaining the format? Because, yeah. You know, unlike all the other Tout Wars, where, you know, it's a little bit different, uses OBP, it's a really wild format. So if you could do that too, that'd be great.
Yeah, so they moved from a head-to-head categories format that had been in place for, I think, the previous two seasons to a points format. But it's unlike a traditional points format in which, you know, in traditional points format, to win the week, it's the person who scores the most points. That's not the case here. You get 2 points for having the most hitting points, 2 points for having the most pitching points, and then 4 points for winning the overall in that week in your competition. Those are the points that go towards the standings. So it also, you got 3 points for an inning from pitchers. You only had 5 points for a win and 5 points for a save, negative three for a loss, negative three for a blown save. The hitting points were pretty standard in terms of if you're playing head-to-head points, negative half point for a strikeout, but still, other than that, it was pretty standard. So I went in thinking that about a third of the league would do your traditional roto split in terms of dollar value, so 70-30 hitters versus pitchers. I thought about a third of the league would do about a 50-50 split, and I thought about a third would do what I ended up doing, but not nearly to the extreme that I did it, which was value pitching more than hitting and put more money that way. I was wrong on that thought, dead wrong. Virtually every single person favored hitting tremendously, and only Clay Link was even close to a 50-50 split in the league. So, I mean, for those who don't know, I spent $200 on my pitching staff, $201 to be exact, and kind of blew a lot of valuations out of the water.
So can you explain, like, you know, why in this format that works, and, you know, it's not like a wacky, zany strategy? Because in any of the other Tout leagues, you know, and I've often said, I go where the value takes me, and, you know, I've had pitching staffs where I'll spend like $100 and people look at me like that's, you know, or $110 even, and people look at me, that's off the wall. And I've won that way. But I've also said, you know, you go up to about $140 in a standard roto on pitching, and, you know, unless like all your hitters work out, you're going to lose. So, like, explain to our listeners why, like, that would or could work in this format.
So with the standings points being awarded based partially on pretty much in three different categories, you know, hitting, pitching, and overall, I made the decision that I wanted to dominate one of those categories and attempt to do enough with my offense to carry me in the overall. And so my thought process was, if I can dominate pitching week to week, and pitchers on average score the most amount of points in this head-to-head format, and, but, you know, by a fair margin for the most part. I felt like if I could just get enough offense, especially in a 12-team league where there's plenty of replacement value out on the wire for me to kind of stream hitters, I felt like I could do a very good job of putting together a roster that would, without balance, could dominate the league. And I feel like my team came out according to plan. So it wasn't like I came in and, with this idea and like, oh, well, this is happening, I'm going to go do this. No, this is something I game planned for about a month and a half before actually pulling it off last Saturday.
You mentioned that you were surprised to find that nobody else skewed their split to the extreme that you did. How far into the draft did you notice that, and what was your initial reaction? Because I'm assuming it was after you probably bought two of the big four there, where you bought Scherzer and Kershaw for 106 combined. At what point did you notice that, and what was sort of your reaction once that happened?
I noticed it after the first player went up for auction. Mike Trout went up for auction first. Andrew Lamont threw him out, and I just watched the room. I knew that I couldn't afford him because I was only going to be spending about $60 on my hitting, and I expected him to go for about $50 to $55. He actually went cheaper than I thought he would, but I noticed that virtually every single person in the room bid on him after he got to $20 and $30. And that told me that nobody was going to be skewing pitching in the direction that I was, or even close to it. By the time I had gotten my second player, because I got the second and third players in Kershaw and in Scherzer that were thrown out, I knew that the room was valuing hitting more than I thought they should. And it pretty much was a matter of how can I contain my excitement? Because I feel like my strategy is going to be very different and have a really good shot of winning because no one else was doing what I was doing. But also, I was a little afraid that maybe the $200 pitching staff was going to be a bit too extreme for the room.
Mike, this is a question for you because you've done so many of these industry auctions. I don't know if you've done that many points league auctions, but I was actually listening to, I think it was one of the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference panels, and they were talking about, I think they were talking to Billy Bean, and one of the points he made was, or it may have been Daryl Morey, who was the GM of the Rockets, who was on the panel as well, and he said, well, it wasn't, if you believe in something, you have to take it to its logical conclusion, which means going all the way with the idea. And like Justin was talking about, it's believing in the value of pitchers and spending as much as he did on them. Do you feel like that makes sense in this type of a league to just not just spend more on pitching, but go all the way as he did?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, in part because of that point, which is, I'm kind of looking at the categories now. So the one points league I do an Otnu league, and that's a, that's a Fangraphs points league. And, you know, I have to say, like, the first year, last year I did it, I finished 11th out of 12 teams. And part of the reason I did is I was looking at it like a traditional roto league, where I was adding players, I was looking at value, and I had a team that was, like, good, but it just, in terms of how you would look at a team in roto, and I had a lot of injuries. Like, I think I would have probably finished, like, 5th or 6th if not for the injuries, but I wouldn't have won. And I would have won because I wasn't embracing the format. So to your point, George, what I did this year is I went more of a stars and scrubs approach in that league because in part, you know, this is true in any 12-team league, you get your stars, you can just discard all those scrubs and just keep churning and churning until we're set. Now, Justin, is this like the other tout leagues where it's like $1,000 fab? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like Otnu is different because you have a salary cap and your fab's tied to it, so you can like very easily be up against the cap at the beginning of the season. I'm not going to turn this into like an Otnu podcast, but nobody wants that. But in tout, in this format, you can pretty much churn guys like over and over and over ad infinitum until you find the players that you like. So even if I might not have done what Justin quite did with the pitching, I do appreciate and embrace like that idea of a stars and scrubs. Like in any format like this, you know, you can get yourself like a Garrett Richards or a Michael Walker or a Michael Fulmer. They might work out. They might not. You can't get a Scherzer and a Kershaw. Like, you just can't. And, you know, if they don't work out, like, that obviously is going to hurt. But again, there's so much replacement talent floating around out there that it's not going to completely knock you out. It's going to hurt, but you can still contend.
I actually made the argument that you know, losing an ace is more disastrous to the team that only has one, as opposed to me who has, you know, two of the top four and then two guys kind of in the second tier of starting pitchers and Robbie Ray and Carlos Martinez. You know, I have the other guys to kind of cover. That, like, you know, if you look over at, like, Paul Spohr's team, you know, he's got Chris Sale at $55, and then his next pitchers are Tanaka, Waka, and Michael Fulmer. He loses Chris Sale, like, that's the end of his season in this league.
Tanaka Waka sounds like one of those, like, Seinfeld memes where people, you know, Jerry and George are like, you got a Tanaka Waka? No, it's a Waka Tanaka. And they go back and forth for 5 minutes.
Why I listen every week, by the way.
Mike's puns are out of this world. They're something else. My question for you, Justin, is I think a lot of fantasy owners would look at your team and say, well, that's crazy. And the reason I say that is because I feel like a lot of fantasy owners wouldn't go this extreme because they worry that if it doesn't work out, it can be a real disaster. Is basically what I'm saying. They don't want to look foolish if this doesn't work. So do you think that there's sort of a bias against going to this extreme for that reason? I'm just wondering, because we don't see more teams do this. So I just wonder if you thought that maybe that was something that fantasy owners think that prevents them from going to this extreme with pitching.
I think that is true, but I also think that is largely because people in the industry don't do this kind of thing. You know, for the most part, you know, people, the average Joes mimic a lot of what we do in the industry, you know, whether it's, you know, guys like us who write in podcasts or guys on the radio on Sirius or on fantasy sports radio, you know, they kind of follow the path that we give them. And like, if you go back and you can go like on a Sirius and listen to the breakdown of Tau Wars and especially the head to head, you know, nobody liked my strategy, which I understood, but like this, you know, one of the problems with points leagues in general from an analyst's point of view is they're all so different. And so it's really hard. And one of the reasons I think the industry at large caters to Roto is because it's really hard to cater to individual point structures. You know, and it's just hard to, you know, cover every single one because everyone is kind of different. I think this happens more often in points leagues than people in the industry think because we don't cater to them as much.
Well, you know, so something I like about your strategy, I don't know how much you got to talk to like Peter Kreutzer when you were there, how much you've talked to him in the past. So, you know, Peter's part of the second oldest rotisserie league there is, like the American Dreams League. And that league, like, you know, Alex Patton's in that league, and he's one of those like innovators who figured out like before there was an innings requirement in fantasy to go with nine relievers. Cause he figured out, you know, this is also 4x4. He figured I can dump wins. I can win three categories and I can sweep hitting. And he did. So they changed the rules. And then one year he figured out there's no at bats requirement. I go no power and I can win at, you know, average in steals and win pitching. And he won. Actually, it wasn't him. It was somebody else. And the person, I think, actually finished like fifth or sixth. But he would have won if he like had done anything with his team. He just kind of drafted and like went home. So from that standpoint, I appreciate it. Like something about the other tout leagues. And don't get me wrong. I love tout. And, you know, I love Roto. Like anyone listening knows I'm not like betraying, you know, what I love here. But watching the head-to-head is just great that way because you get to see people – either think out. I think you have to think outside of the box or suffer. You know, there were a couple teams in there that I was watching while I was manning the spreadsheet where I felt like they weren't doing that, and I felt like they were like there was one person who was just drafting or auctioning, kind of from that Roto perspective. And I'm not knocking that person because, like I said, I did that a not new last year. these leagues challenge you, and that's some of the fun of fantasy is, you know, putting yourself in a position where you're challenged as opposed to where, all right, you know, it's my home league, it's the same people, I've done this for 15 years, I'm better than all of them, or there's one person who's kind of challenges me, but everybody else I can beat.
Yeah,
and if anyone my home league is listening, I'm sorry.
If you go conventional, you're not as likely to be criticized for making a strategic mistake. You know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. kind of what I was talking about earlier.
I go through that too. Like, you know, or Doug Dennis is a great example. You know, Doug Dennis spends $30 on his pitching staff almost every year in labor, and he gets maligned for it. It's like, well, you know, Doug won with that once, and I know it doesn't sound impressive because he's been in the league a long time, but there's some people in those leagues a long time who never win. Like, you have to kind of do what works for you. And I think that's the other thing we lose in the expert leagues, which is we all talk about we want to win this, that, and the other. These leagues are hard to win. Like, they just are. Like, even if you're, like, twice as successful as everyone else in the league, that means you're going to win once every 6 years. It just – there's, like, three or four people in these leagues that kind of rise above that, and it they're difficult. Like, it's just not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, I think as long as you have a reason for what you're doing, a strategy that makes sense to you, like, I'm open to anything. You know what I mean? I would love to see extremes like this. So, Justin, I want to ask you real quickly to wrap up on your hitting. I know you said you're going to be looking to, you know, stream and pick up guys in season and cobble it together on that end, but I noticed there were a lot of Justin Mason hallmarks on this team. Bradley Zimmer, a lot of guys I know you like. You know, there's Chris Stratton on reserves there. Who do you think are going to be some of the keys on your offense or some of the picks that you liked that you felt like were really good values for you in this draft?
I mean, you know, the Bradley Zimmer pick was probably a mistake. That was like, you know, that was a total moment of weakness. Like, Bradley Zimmer's my guy. Don't you dare take him.
We all have him. Yeah.
You know, because he's not great for this format with the amount he can strike out. And so he may actually get jettisoned pretty quick. I really liked what I did in the end game on my offense. I got Brandon Belt, Mitch Haniger, Matt Chapman in all for a dollar, and then Michael Conforto for two. I really feel like I got some pretty nice upside with those last four offensive players, especially Brandon Belt, who, while I've been very critical of him as a roto commodity in this format, he actually has some pretty sneaky value because he hits doubles and he walks a ton. And that is extremely valuable in this format. So I liked him. Conforto, I felt at $2 was a steal, especially in Tout, which has unlimited DL spots.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. Like, Murphy and Conforto, like, I you know, in some leagues with a limited DL, like with Murphy and a 12 team, I'd be like, you know, it's kind of risky. But in this league, you can just keep him, those guys down, and it's like having free players until they come back.
Daniel Murphy at $9, I think, is in, especially in this format.
Right,
he's going to be big. If he comes back soon and he looks good, like you said, you have the DL spots to be able to stash it. And when he comes back, he's going to make a difference. So I like that pick. All right. Any other final thoughts here on Justin's team, Mike? Or Justin, do you have any final things you wanted to say before we dig into Mike's team?
Last thing I'll mention, I probably should have mentioned this earlier. You know, I spent $17 total dollars between my two catchers. And JT Realmuto and Evan Gattis, and a lot of people had questions about why a catcher was my highest priced player. The drop off in catcher in this format is huge in terms of projected points. My projections had over half of the catchers in this league giving negative value.
Yeah, you know, if we, you know, we might dive into the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational, like, after we do Tout. You know, I will say, like, that's Justin's baby and this, like, awesome, like, experts, like, league of leagues.
It's cool.
But, you know, one catcher versus two catcher formats, just such a difference. Like if you only play one catcher, you add that second catcher, it really changes the dynamic of how you should value them. And I'm used to two catchers, so it works the other way. But that was one thing you did I completely agree with. And actually, you know, Dr. Roto, like that team as well, you know, Posey and Ramos, you might look at like, it's a lot on two catchers. But really think that's the, you know, Posey might have been too much, given that Contreras went for 11. But in terms of the idea behind it, it was the right play.
Well, and I mean, Posey's, you know, really valuable in this format as well,
right,
because of how much he walks.
Yeah, you know, and we'll get into that into my Tau team, because, you know, I wound up with him. And yeah, you know, there's definitely, when walks count, you know, a player like Posey really gets elevated, even though he's not a big power hitter.
Didn't you draft four catchers one time, Mike, in the NL?
I did, as a matter okay. of fact. I did that in 2016.
There we go. I remember correctly. That was a fun pod.
Todd Zola did that once as well.
You're not the first, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I was not the pioneer.
All right, this has been a fun pod. All right, let's talk about the Tout Wars NL draft. Mike, this is, as you said, this is getting close to 10 years now. Is it 10 years in the NL or 10 years total?
It's both all NL, so it's my ninth year in the NL, and I haven't been offered to switch, but I wouldn't like to switch. Like, I really like the group in the NL. It's a fun group.
Yeah. So you won this league in 2016?
2015. Yeah, it all blends together.
We've been doing this a while. All right. So take me through the team here. Maybe we should do what we had Justin do, where you tell us a little bit about the format and your strategy and just your overall approach going into it, because I think a lot of our listeners may not know.
Yeah, so I mean, this is a little simpler, because, you know, it's 5x5, it's NL only, it's 12 team, and, you know, the one wrinkle is it's on base percentage instead of batting average. And, you know, the one thing about that, and this kind of is why I went the direction I went in, it tends to reward stars and scrubs a little bit more than a batting average format, particularly with the on base players. So, you know, one of the, you know, you mentioned 2015, and, you know, I didn't intend to do this specifically, but when I won that year, you know, I won with Paul Goldschmidt as my anchor hitter and Clayton Kershaw as my anchor pitcher. And, you know, the funny thing about that was I made some missteps that year. I spent a combined $29. You know, I'm sorry to go back to 2015, because I'm sure everyone loves to hear this, but I spent a combined $29 on Devin Mesoraco and Willen Rosario as my catchers.
Oh, my God.
I bought like Doug Fister and Andrew Kashner and Youngjin Ryu for a combined like 30. And this is important, by the way, to give the context for this current team, by the way. I'm not bringing this up just to give the history lesson, right, you know, as pitchers. And ultimately, it didn't matter, because that was the power of like a Clayton Kershaw as an ace and a Paul Goldschmidt as an on-base percentage king. So the strategy I had was kind of hearkening back to that and being like, regardless of what else I do, I'm going to get an on-base anchor and I'm going to get an ace. Now, you know me, you know, and Justin, you listen, so you know too, there's a price that I would have stopped at. Like, if Derek Hardy, if this is the year, and he hasn't been doing this year, but if he was like, I have to get Kershaw, and he paid like, you know, 43, I would have been out on Kershaw. And, you know, if someone else, you know, Max Scherzer went for 40, I don't think I would have went to 41. I don't have adjusted. But as it turned out, you know, Paul Goldschmidt came up early and I got him for 38, and my price on him was 40. And Clayton Kershaw, you know, my price on him was 41 and I got him for 39. So I have my anchors. And, you know, from that point, the team kind of flowed from there.
You know, that's a good point. I think I've noticed this as well. When I prepare for an auction, one of the biggest things I do is I compare my values with sort of the general consensus, or what I think the competition, where they're going to value a certain player. And it's usually I look at the top end, because I want to target, like you said, those anchors early. So I look at, you know, where my value is on Joey Votto versus where I think the rest of the league is. So I think that's a good point. It was helpful to get Goldschmidt and Kershaw early. And I want to ask you about your outfield here, because you ended up with a couple of really nice speed guys, Starling Marte, Billy Hamilton, Chris Taylor. Taylor also versatile. I really like how the offense came together for you. I think you have a lot of options here that are interesting.
Yeah, so a couple of things. If there's one thing I don't like about my offense, the scrubs, with the, you know, when I say scrub, I'm talking about someone like $3 or under. So I like Jorge Alfaro. He's not a good OBP guy, But, you know, everybody here in Philadelphia who's watched him during spring training is like, oh, my God, like he is so strong and he's big and he's actually lost some weight, but he's still like a big dude. Like he could hit 20 home runs. Like he could easily do that if, you know, even if the average and the on-base percentage is bad. You know, with Goldschmidt and with Schwarber, I have some cushion to kind of like, you know, like take that. But the other scrubs I got, like, you know, Martin Prado, who could be nothing, JT Riddle, who quite honestly is garbage, and Eric Sogard, who I'm essentially rooting for Jonathan VR to fall on his face, which is possible, but even if he does, it's Eric Sogard. It's not optimal. But, you know, otherwise, you're right. Like, I kind of look at the outfielders, I look at the speed, you know, and this again goes back to my approach with value. Some people would look at Hamilton and Marte and go, you made a mistake, you know, you added too much speed. It's like, well, you know, first of all, I'm going to win steals. Like, that, you know, unless one of them gets hurt or, you know, unless, like, Marte gets pinched again, God forbid, I'm going to win steals. And the funny thing is, unlike some, you know, analysts, I don't draft or auction against the projections. So when I ran the PFM projections against, you know, my team, I thought that the power was going to be middling. But it's actually a pretty good power team. It projects out to fourth in home runs and second in runs batted in, which I was floored by. I was like, that they're, yeah, like, really? Like, that doesn't seem right. Now, wow. Some of that is it's projecting Hunter Pence a little optimistically and kind of building in some of his past. But, you know, there's some good power on this team. And again, some of it is that in an NL only, like, the guys who are not the scrubs, like the next level up, they're really not that good.
Kyle Schwarber, Pakoda really believes in Schwarber. I mean, you got him for 19. I think he's sort of the make or break guy, where if he does what Pakoda thinks he can do and what we know Brett Sayre thinks Kyle Schwarber can do, he could be the difference on this team. And go ahead. We were talking about this before we started recording, but
yeah. Well, here's the thing about Schwarber. So, if you believe, you know, again, like splits and arbitrary endpoints, if you believe that the second half last year was fluky and he is what he is, and yes, it's an OBP league, but if you believe he's average in OBP and just kind of a guy, it's like, yeah, this isn't a good pick, or it's kind of a borderline pick. Yes. But if you believe that in the first half last year, he was recovering from the injury, he was adjusting, he wasn't comfortable, and the second half is closer to his true talent, then yeah. I mean, I think the funny thing about that is if you split the difference between his first half and his second half, you're still probably looking at like a 30 home run guy with an average OBP,
yeah,
which at this price I'll take.
Justin, where do you stand on Kyle Schwarber? I don't know if I've heard your thoughts on him. What do you think?
I'm not a Kyle Schwarber fan.
Okay.
I think if he was in the American League and he could DH, I would absolutely love him. But I think the defensive liability will always limit his plate appearance upside.
Where would you be comfortable projecting him home run wise? Do you see him more as like a 20 home run guy than a challenging for 30 plus? Or
where do I think you see? Yeah, I would probably put him in the middle of that, 25 to 30.
Okay.
So like, and I don't like NL only. You know, he walks. So obviously, you know, he's a strong OBP asset. I don't mind the price at all here. He's just not a guy that ends up on my team ever, really.
Yeah, I would say that, like, based on what Justin's saying, even in this format at 19, he could be a par player because mm-hmm. it's not a batting average league.
And if for some reason other injuries on the team force him into the lineup and not being replaced defensively, like, he could earn, you know, 30 bucks. I could easily see that.
So the funny thing here is I made a weird little hedge with Albert Almora.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of the hedge was like, well, Almora is not going to play every day barring an injury. But if you believe that Schwarber is going to sit or get, like, replaced, Almora could easily earn this in an only, you know, in 300 plate appearances or so.
And I love that. I love that addition to your team. I also love the fact that you got, you know, I'm not a Chris Taylor guy either. But, you know, his position.
Those are fighting words for George.
He knows that. We've had this discussion.
We have.
Over on the FWFB pod. But in an NL only, having that positional flexibility where he can go in and cover, you know, for JT Riddle or Eric Sogard. And then you have Almora in the swing position because Tout Wars has an odd position where it can be a pitcher or a hitter. You can throw a pitcher in that spot, move Almora into cover for Taylor. I like that added positional flexibility that you put in there.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing, too, about Taylor is I have him in labor, too. And that's part of what I baked into his price. Like, I baked in that flexibility. I've had problems in only leagues where I haven't had a player like that. You know, or it's been a guy who's like a low-end $1 player, and you're like, yeah, like, I, you know, it's great to have the flexibility, but if it's like Daniel Descalso, like, who cares?
Yeah. I mean, we're not necessarily a hot take machine here. I think everything we do is sort of rooted in valuation and numbers, and everything I see based on watching Taylor and what the numbers say, like, he's not bad. I just think he doesn't have the track record of doing this for long enough, and people still are anchored to that failed prospect. And look, I get it, but
the funny thing with Taylor though is I agree, you know, and Justin, I know, you know, you guys don't use Pecota, you have your own systems, but I agree with Pecota. Like Pecota says that the power is going to drop off, but that the speed is legitimate, and, you know, that he should still steal 15 to 20 bases. And, like, that's kind of something I kind of buy into. So, you know, I think to George's point, like, a lot of what's, like, my team does kind of rely on Schwarber in terms of him coming close to what that projection is. You know, and then the other guy who's risky is Ryan Zimmerman. We haven't even talked about him. Mm-hmm. Like, I think his price is fair, and, you know, if he even does like 80% of what he did last year, it's a bargain. But we know the risk with him. You know, we know the risk that Ryan Zimmerman, he's not a young guy. He has like a weird, funky health history. And, oh, by the way, like, there's this mysterious thing going on with him in Florida where he's not playing and he's on the backfields, and it's like Metsian, like the Nationals, like, oh, it's fine, like, he's gonna play, and it's like, well, you know, is he? Like, I hope so, but, you know, all that aside, like, he could be really good again, and he could be nothing. Like, this price is really in the middle, but we know how players like this work out. It's kind of like they either work out really well or they don't at all.
But yeah, he's definitely not going to earn $16. He's either going to earn a fair amount less or a fair amount more.
Well, the funny thing is, Gray Albright called him out at 15. And, like, there was, like, a lull, and I said 16, and I could almost – you could almost hear the sigh where he was like, oh, like, I'm glad I didn't get him.
That's pretty funny. Justin's right. I mean, Zimmerman is that boom or bust type of guy. But that ties into your overall strategy, where when you have the anchors, you can afford to take some chances like that, where if it doesn't work out,
right,
you're still going to be okay overall, and you can cobble it together with the rest of the roster and find other guys.
The other thing, too, is again, you know, we mentioned him in Justin's segment. Buster Posey in this format is kind of underrated, and I'm not a Posey guy. Like, I'm just not. He's okay, but he's that guy who always seems to go over what my price is. Like, someone always pays like 25 with a 260 budget. They love him. They're paying for the pass. You know, he's not going to – I don't think he's going to put up a 400 on base percentage like he did last year. But there's just value in that category, and he's just somebody who always manages to get on base. And the other thing I like about him, too, is with the Giants' improved lineup, he should score more runs and drive in more runs. So – I was really surprised to get him. Like, I just thought he'd sail past price. And you know, if someone said 21, I would have let him go. And I was like, all right, if you're going to let me have Buster Posey at 20, that's fine.
All right. I have to ask about the pitching, because you spent 39 on Kershaw. You bought Felipe Rivero for 16, who we all think is a very good closer. But you talked a lot about the importance of getting an ace, especially in a mono league. You can't win without an elite starting pitcher, basically.
Well, I mean, you can.
There's an exception to every rule, but the valuations tell us that it's really difficult to do without it. So, were you expecting to be going $1 and $2 with the rest of the staff, or, I mean, because I don't know, I wasn't there, so I didn't see the order in which these guys came out or anything, but was that sort of the mindset going in after you bought Kershaw?
No, there were a few plans. Actually, believe it or not, I bid 39 on Max Scherzer before he went for 40 to Greg Mish of SiriusXM. There was a plan where I had Kershaw, Scherzer, and 7 $1 pitchers. And, you know, to Justin's point, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go with the two aces. There's less risk. And, you know, if one gets hurt, I still have the other one. You know, if both get hurt, I'm screwed. But that's true with any, like, two anchors on any team anyway. So what happened was this. I had this plan in Labor Ale. And, you know, Justin, if you listen to the podcast, you probably remember this. In Labor Ale, I wanted to get one of Kluber, Kimbrel, and Sale in that order. And then I wound up, like, getting all those hitters early, and my plan was completely screwed. And I was still bidding on Kluber and Kimbrel. I just missed out on them. And then I went with, like, a low-end staff. So in Tout, I kind of decided, like, I'm like, you know what? I'm either getting Kershaw or Scherzer for 39, or I'm letting someone else get them for 40. So I got Kershaw. And then I wanted Jansen, but he just sailed past price. Todd Zola and Tristan Cockcroft were in the bidding war on him. So I didn't have a plan at that point. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to fill out on the back end, like, and kind of see how the values fall. And Rivera was the guy who fell to me. And he's not Jansen. Like, I'm not going to oversell him as that. But if you double Rivero's saves from last year, and again, that this is not something analytically sound, he would have been a $28 pitcher. I'm not predicting that. I think he's more of like a low 20s pitcher in terms of what he can earn. But in an only league, there's some underrated value in what relievers can do for your peripherals. So the rest of the staff is a pull and price staff. But here's the funny thing about it. If you take last year's numbers of these nine pitchers and you apply it to last year's Tout Wars, it's a second-place team in wins, ERA, and WHIP. And that includes, like, Clayton Richards' bad, 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 horrible numbers. Like, I didn't just take nine pitchers who were good last year and go, like, see, they're going to be really good. Like, I just took nine guys where I was like, you know what? Maybe they'll work. Maybe they won't. Like, we'll see what happens. And the way staffs like this work outside of Kershaw is – you stream the guys that you don't like. So in labor, you have to – the guys you buy, you have to either keep in your lineup or cut in the only leagues. In Tout, you can use your reserve list to, like, keep those guys down when they're in Colorado, or, you know, keep them out of a bad matchup. And that's what I'm going to be doing all year. Like, I'm going to be streaming these pitchers. I'm going to be, like, playing around with them. You know, will it work? Like, I don't really know. But the power of Kershaw in an only – is underrated. So there's some people who look at him and are like, he's going to get hurt. It's like, well, he might, or even if you think he probably will, you know, by my numbers, he was a $35 plus earner, even in the years. He's really good. Like 160, 170 innings of Kershaw is more powerful than any pitcher who's not named Max Scherzer. Like, that's how good he is.
I'm not going to bring it up. All right, I'm going to not bring it up. All right, don't comment on other people's teams. I love AJ Minter at $2. And Trevor
everybody,
Williams.
Everybody did. Oh, my God. Yeah. Like, Minter was one of the guys at the end. And, Phil Hertz and I were, like, both spent our money early. And Phil was waiting on him, and I was waiting on him. And Phil said one, and I said two. And, like, Phil, who is not someone to curse, like, he let a curse under his breath. He was pissed.
Well, for good reason. AJ Minter strikes everyone out, and if he's healthy for 50 innings,
fine, and, like, Minter doesn't get any saves, he's going to strike out a bunch of guys.
Oh yeah, Justin, were there any pitchers here that you wanted to highlight, or anything that we haven't talked about with Mike's team that needs to be said? It needs to go on the record.
I mean, you kind of nailed it, I think, with Minter. I just love the price there. And actually, with the amount of hype he's gotten this spring, I'm surprised, one, that he was still around at the end, and two, that he only went for $2. I really like what you did in the reserve rounds, grabbing Brandon Kinsler and Seth Lugo, two guys that, you know, maybe don't have a flashy role right now, but could at some point for their respective squads. And then obviously Tapia and Brendan Rodgers, both Colorado guys that could have bigger roles if injuries or underperformance hit the Rockies this year. So I really like what you did, not only just in your end game of your auction, but in the reserve.
I appreciate that. You know, and the thing with those reserve picks is, I know it's crowded in Colorado in terms of the outfield, but, like, Tapia, I feel like he'll find a way.
He's ready.
Yeah, and, you know, Rodgers is one of those players who, if he starts out quickly, or if Trevor Story struggles and he gets promoted, fine. If he doesn't, I'm not afraid to cut him and just look elsewhere.
Mike, do you want to talk about the Joey Chassin origin story of how our like,
God.
2 years ago, I was like, you know, Chassin, he's pitching well. And then you picked him up, and he got lit up for, like, 2 months.
There's somebody, you know, Justin, there's someone over at your site who loves Chassin. Is it Jason Collette? I think it is.
Yeah, it might be. I don't know. Like, I can't get on board the Chassin.
Well, unfortunately.
Now I think about it, Jeff Sullivan wrote a piece about him, too, and, you know, he kind of, like, hedged at the end. He's like, look, he's like, I'm not trying to say he's going to be like an ace. Kind of what I was just saying before, you know, he's like, he's not going to be an ace, but he could be a mid-tier guy. Chassin is somebody I plan to stream on the road. I really don't want to start him in Milwaukee. Like, his home road splits last year are scary on the roadside. Mm-hmm. And he's moving to the worst park he could have moved to outside of Coors.
But yeah, that's the scary part.
better supporting cast, though. Like, if you're going to stream him exclusively on the road, like, there are potential for wins there, I think, definitely.
Well, that's what it is. If I can get, like, you know, 16 starts out of him and hopefully use him either exclusively or mostly on the road, yeah. I'm fine with
Jason,
that.
Jason Vargas is kind of like that, too. Like, obviously, he broke his hand, so that he might miss some time, but, like...
Which I think happened, you know, 5 minutes after I bought it.
Yeah, like, if you can pick your spots with him, he does have some value in an only league. Like, definitely. I mean, he won a lot of games last year, and obviously that means nothing now, but... You know, he's fine for $2, whatever.
Well, I think the thing with all these pitchers, and you know, to kind of just like kind of finish on this philosophically. So, I've found in all the research I've done over the years on valuation and looking at numbers and brackets where pitchers go, the aces tend to perform better than we expect and closer returning value than we expect. Yes, you know, Madison Bumgarner or Noah Syndergaard crashes and burns, but for the most part. Even the disappointments aren't that disappointing. It's those guys in an only who go for like 14, 15, 16, 17, you know, that range, who really tend to just completely fall off the face of the earth. Like, think Johnny Cueto last year. He was a little more expensive than that, but think that kind of pitcher. So I'm looking at it like, you know what? Yeah, these pitchers are low end, but with Kershaw on the staff, I only need one of them to be decent. I don't even need one to be an ace. Like, I just need one of them to be like a $15 earner. And everything else will kind of work itself out. And I know that sounds like ridiculous. Like, if you're thinking, oh yeah, like, you know, if all six fail, like, you suck, Mike, and that's not true. But from my experience, it's pretty much how it plays out. Like, if the ace works out and just one of these guys turns into a competent, like, second tier, like, bottom of the second tier arm, it's going to work.
Well, and if you can stream the combination of Chassin on the road with Trevor Williams at home, that's a pretty valuable pitcher for a total of $3.
Yeah. I said I wasn't going to do it, but you know what? The hell with it. I'm going to do it. So friend of the pod, Steve Gardner, got Charlie Blackmon for $32. I'm trying to figure out, obviously I said, like I said, I wasn't there. How did that happen? Because that price in relation to everything else I see, it doesn't make sense. Like, it's way too low, I think.
Well, I would agree. So he is a little less valued in an OBP, so that's part of it. But I would agree that like Blackman's price should have been higher. I know Steve was really, really pleased with that, and he should be.
Yeah. All right.
Steve's a really good guy, and he deserved that.
he is awesome. We love Steve. We had him on a couple of weeks ago.
We have him on every year to talk about labor, and it's great.
Yeah, if you missed that episode, definitely go check it out. All right, guys. Any final thoughts? I know a lot of people are going to be drafting this weekend. We've talked for like an hour here about the Tout Wars Expert Leagues, but do you have any just general pieces of advice for people or anything that you've noticed strategically that fantasy owners should take into account as they go into a draft this weekend, anything like that? And I'll let you go first, Justin, if there's anything that you've picked up that you want to leave people with.
You know, I mean, one, know your rules. I think that was like the big key from my, like, understand the rules, understand the format where you can kind of gain an advantage, and then be pliable, be able to, you know, if your first plan goes all to hell, be able to kind of change directions if you need to. So, yeah, that's usually how I approach an auction.
You know who's pliable, Justin? Mm. Take a guess. Tom Brady. Very pliable. He's very into the pliability. Mm. Mike, what's your best piece of advice? I know we did the auction strategy podcast last week, but we left a lot of meat on the bone. So let's what else you got for people?
You know, the biggest thing I have is, you know, as you're going through, and especially if it's an auction, like as you're going through your auction, don't lose confidence in what you're doing. Like if you're putting your team together and look like, you know, the Marte Hamilton example with me, I have to say there was a moment when I looked at my team and I was like, oh man, like I bought both these guys. Like, how is it going to work? And after the fact, I looked at this team. I'm like, you know what? It's better than I thought. Like it's not going to win home runs and runs batted in, but there's enough power there where I could be mid pack and I'm going to win steals and I'm going to be pretty good on base percentage and runs. So I think people get caught sometimes in category targets, and I'm not saying they're not useful, but if you get too wrapped up in them or you get too wrapped up and I have to have this player, I have to have, you know, this type of team, you can put yourself into a really bad position depending on how your auction's going.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think a lot of times people think, am I valuing these players? Are my values incorrect? But maybe the rest of your league is off. You know what I mean? So maybe you're mm-hmm. correct. So don't lose faith. That's a good point. I guess my last point would be, and we didn't bring this up on the last pod, but this is a Larry Schechter thing, but nominating is an advantage. I think a lot of fantasy owners, when they go into auctions, it can be intimidating. And they think, well, I just want to throw out players and get money off the table so that mm-hmm. I have an advantage later. I'm going to have more money than other people. But oftentimes, that's when the best deals are, early in a draft. And then you run out of elite players, well, and you're left holding a pile of cash. And
well, I was just going to say, you have to play to the dynamic of each auction you're in. Like,
right.
Like I know there's – so, like, in labor, you know, not to, to, like – I was going to make the belabor pun, but I won't. But I realized by saying I won, I already did. So in labor AL, like I bought those players early, and, you know, Glenn Colton and Rick Wolf were sitting next to me, like, wow, you never do that. It's like, well, I almost never do that because people tend to overspend early. But sometimes I do because, you know, once in a while, people, for whatever reason, are conservative.
Yeah.
So you just can't be afraid to get out of a comfort zone. You can never be the point of, like, I have to get two catchers for 20, or I have to do this, or I have to do that. And, you know, go back to Justin's auction. Like, that's something I thought he did really well in the head-to-head, which is he wasn't like, well, I have to fit this model of the way people do things.
Right.
Like, yep. Like, do what works for you.
Yeah. So to round out my point, I guess have a purpose behind every nomination. Don't just throw out a player because you're trying to get money off the table. I think that's a seriously flawed way to looking at things. So have a purpose behind the player you're nominating. Whether I have two players valued similarly and I think I can get a bigger discount on one of them, I want to bring that player out first so I'll know. And don't worry about positions either. I think people get caught up in, well, I don't have a second baseman, and they freak out and feel like they have to buy a second baseman. Don't worry about that.
Can I ask, you know, in terms of nominations, I want to ask Mike this question because he's been in labor in tout for a long time. Do you see a real strategic advantage? And maybe you guys covered this in the last episode. I'm only about 15 or 20 minutes into it. Do you see a strategic advantage to throwing out players at, you know, higher prices? Because, like, I saw it backfire quite a bit in my auction, where people threw out guys for $20, $30, and then just crickets.
I would say no. So, you know, if you're talking about throwing out a guy like $5 under his price, that could work, and you might get the guy. Like I think a lot of that comes back to knowing what your price point is. If your price point is 40 and you throw a guy out at 42, then – like, why would you do that? But if you're throwing – so I'll give a good example. In 2015, you know, the year I won, Tristan Cockcroft, he threw out Max Scherzer at his price, and he got him. I think it was, like, at 32.
Wasn't it the first
So I threw out Kershaw – yes.
Yeah.
And I threw out Kershaw at 30. And I got him for 37. I think my price was like, 40 or 41. And I did that because I was like, you know what? Like, there's a psychology to this in that – I think if Tristan hadn't thrown out Scherzer and I'd thrown Kershaw at 30, he goes for the low to mid 40s because, you know, he's Kershaw. But because there was a freeze on Scherzer, there was a similar freeze on Kershaw where people were still kind of like, whoa, like what just happened? So there's moments you can pick and choose to do that. But always do it – still do it below your price. Like, don't throw a guy out and then have a feeling of, like, oh, wait a minute. Like, I thought the room would just go crazy. Like, it's like anything else. Like, in the end game, it's the same thing. If you throw a guy out at a dollar, you better be happy you want him at a dollar. Like, don't throw someone out and think someone's going to say two. It just might not happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we see this way too often in some of these industry leagues. A guy's getting cute. And thinking that they're, you know, I think a lot of people don't want to be the guy that throws Mike Trout out at a dollar, and, you know, because you get relentlessly mocked for doing so, which is fair. But, you know, there were a number of different people, but many times in my auction that threw guys out at $10 or $20 that nobody in the room had valued nearly that high.
And yeah,
that's
cost yourself $3 or $4.
I mean, that's a good point too. Like in the onlys, it's really difficult to do that just because, you know, we all know everybody's worth and there's less variance. And, you know, if I throw Ozzie Albies out at $8, I'm not getting him for $8. Like he's going for $20 or close to it. But yeah, in those mixed formats, I'd rather throw a guy out for $1 and have people ridicule me than throw a guy out for $12, get him, and then be like, wait a minute, like I don't want him.
Yeah, I think – I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but this is something I think Tristan Cockcroft of ESPN, he's talked about, is that there's usually like a soft spot in every auction where after the first couple of players, usually people tend to get a little bit conservative because there are still a few elite players out there, and you know, some people who were going to be aggressive really have done that where you can throw out guys and actually get – pretty decent bargains on that. That's something he's picked up. I don't know if you guys have noticed that as well, that not necessarily saying like you should throw out a guy who's worth $3 and see if you can get him for $1, but
it depends on your auction.
Yeah.
I'd say it's a little bit harder in Tout and Labor because like everybody knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
But it does happen, like even in those expert leagues. Like I've noticed it'll happen after a break or right before a break sometimes. Mm. Like before a break if people are getting tired and it's been going for a while, or I think in Labor this year it happened after one of the food breaks where like two or three players went under value just because the room was kind of sluggish.
Yeah. that tends to happen.
Like you wouldn't think that's the thing. You wouldn't think it would happen to experts, but you know, we're just human and we get tired.
And a lot of us like to eat.
We certainly do.
Very fair. All right, so that's gonna do it. We'll take a quick break and we'll come back and wrap up the show. And we're back. Thank you for listening to episode 164 of Flags Fly Forever. This has been a Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Podcast. I want to thank our guest, Justin Mason, for coming on. He's now an official friend of the pod. Justin, seriously, thanks for being here. This was so much fun, and we're definitely going to have you back on again soon.
Yeah, looking forward to coming back again because I really enjoyed this.
You got anything to plug while you're here? You got to get those plugs in, man.
Oh, God. So much stuff to plug. You can read all my written work on Fangraphs, Fantasy Alarm, Fantrax, and Friends of Fantasy Benefits. You can hear me on the Sleeper in the Bus podcast, Fantasy Sports Radio Network, and all the Friends of Fantasy Benefits podcasts.
You sound like you have a lot of free time. I just...
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. All right. So you can follow. Where can they follow you on Twitter, Justin? What's your handle?
Oh yeah, you can follow me at Justin Mason FWFB. You can also follow the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational at TGFBI. You know, we'll have to do maybe another episode where we have Brett on and talk about the Invitational and your guys' teams.
Absolutely. I mean, we talked for, an hour and a half here, and we didn't even get to it yet. So definitely going to have to do that. By the way, Brett, he had to leave early for vacation. That's the only reason he's not here this week. Yeah, he wanted to beat the Nor'easter. So.
It's all right. He was avoiding me all throughout Tout Wars anyways.
He's a busy guy. What can I say?
He looks very fashionable at Tout Wars, I noticed.
He did.
I was like sitting there in like my, you know, not sweats, but like, you know, just kind of a ruddy shirt and jeans. And I'm looking at him like, damn, like he looked good.
He did some pitching, too, I'm pretty sure.
He did. He did Scherzer and Sale, I believe.
Well, I mean, he actually pitched in the batting cages.
Oh, you mean literally?
Yeah, like he threw in the batting cages, which, like, I, like, you know, a lot of guys went in there and embarrassed themselves, and I was, I didn't have the guts to even try to embarrass myself. So, like, I had a lot of props to the guys who actually went in there and took some live BP from Nick Pollock.
We're gonna need some video. We're gonna do some swing analysis on the next edition. That's definitely our plan. So you can read Mike and I at baseballprospectus.com. Subscribe today with a 1-year premium membership. We have our model portfolios we're doing this week, which is a cool exercise. We do it every year. I am going for broke because I want to win this competition this year. I'm tired of just, you know, competing. I want to win some of these contests we do every year. So I'm going to build the craziest model portfolio you've ever seen. Go check it out this week at BP. If you do the super premium membership, you get access to the Bat Signal. Subscribe, rate, review us on iTunes. If you're a new listener, you like what we do, that's the best way you can support us. Every rating or review seriously does help us out tremendously. So go do that. You can follow Mike on Twitter at Mike Gianella. I am at George Bissell. We'll be back next week. We're going to get you ready for the season. If you are drafting this weekend, good luck. I hope these two guys helped you out. They got a lot of knowledge between them, so I hope it was useful to you. And until our next show, so long, everybody. By the way, I noticed Odubel Herrera spelled Obel Herrera.
Yeah, there were some typos on the NL sheet, and